Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. Is your child struggling with academic or behavioral problems? Do they talk about suicide or engage in high-risk behavior? Has your child shut you out and left you wondering why they are so withdrawn, angry, and sad? What should you do to intervene, and how do you know the difference between normal teenage behavior and behavior that could benefit from professional intervention? On today's edition of Line One, Your Health Connection, everything you need to know if you are considering therapy for your child, where to begin, and what to expect. Joining me for today's conversation are Anchorage therapist Maureen Young and Krista Pemberton from Fuller Diagnostics. Welcome to the program. I appreciate you both taking the time to join me today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
I want folks to remember this is a call-in show. We welcome your thoughts and questions. If you've had an experience with therapy as a teen, good or bad, and want to share that with us, please don't hesitate to call in or email. We'd love to hear from you. As always, we can be reached in one of three ways. Our local phone number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Or if you're outside of Anchorage, you can reach us on our toll-free number. That's 1-888-353-5752. And the last way you can participate is to email your questions or comments to line1@alaskapublic.org. If you've never emailed, you got to spell out line one, line1@alaskapublic.org. All right, I guess let's start off but with a little introduction from each of you. Krista, we can start off with you. I will say you are related to me, or not actually technically, my sister-in-law. So we've the same name is not a coincidence. So tell us a little bit about what you do and your background and what you specialize in.
Absolutely. So I was born and raised quite proudly in Anchorage, but I think I really started my journey towards the helping profession in Washington, D.C. when I was in college. I spent 2 years working in AmeriCorps, really with the program that at the time we were calling intergenerational programming, which was a fantastic opportunity to really take the needs of a community and match those resources and strengths with all of the challenges that the community was presenting. And the main part of what the work we did there was matching isolated seniors with either middle school or elementary school students to be involved in mentorship and also service. So allowing the kids to do that service to support the older adults in their community, as well as helping those older adults provide their love and wisdom and mentorship. And then we, both Maureen and I, attended the graduate school together and sort of have been sort of therapeutically aligned since then. And after graduate school, I worked at Providence, and I was actually in a float position with the medical units there, which was not the favored position to have, to be floating, but for me was an absolute gift because I was able to work across the lifespan, all the way from the neonatal ICU and mother baby to being able to work with chronically ill children, emergency department with sexual assault, domestic violence, all the way through grief, death, and aging. And so Maureen and I started our private practice about 7 years ago. And Dr. Christy Fuller, who we work with, one of the neuropsychologists in our office, was a great mentor for us and was really passionate at the time, after working with so many families, about the gaps in services that there were for the people that she was seeing, that she was referring, and was a great guide for us as far as where these holes were in the work that was being done, especially with group work and with the autism spectrum disorder community, for focus on those social skills pieces as well as the individual therapy pieces. And so as we sort of started to build our private practice, we had a lot of passion for working with adolescents and with youth.
Maureen, you guys have sort of developed, I think, I send a lot of young folks your way. You guys have developed a pretty good reputation as far as adolescent girls and the autistic sort of spectrum area. So What's your focus? What are you working on these days that's really filling up your bucket, so to speak?
Well, the vast majority of our practice really is adolescent girls and a few adolescent boys. I think Krista and I have an incredible passion for working with teenagers, and I think that there are many, parents and even some providers who say, teenagers are so difficult. How do you do that? But for us, they are an absolute joy to work with. We also have, at least for myself, a huge portion of my practice is working with pretty young kids. Six is about as low as they tend to go because they don't do traditional play therapy. My office isn't set up for that, although we do have another provider in our office who is becoming licensed to do so. But I think there's a huge need in our community for providers that are able to work with very young children, because I think many of the providers that have done that work are coming up on retirement and getting ready to leave the community. And so there's a pretty large gap. As Krista mentioned, that's something that Dr. Fuller's been able to guide us in because she does so many of the neuropsychological evaluations for that age group.
Yeah, that it's an underserved population, and there's not a lot of folks. I did a program with, I can't remember her name, Lori Houston, out in Wasilla, mm-hmm. on child and play therapy, and it was really informative and good, so folks want to find out more about that. But for today's program, we're focusing mostly on the preteen, teen kids, and so there's a big difference between working with a 11-year-old and a 17-year-old, for sure, but it seems to be that around 11, 12, that brain starts to shift, and there's a sort of an awareness of the adult brain coming online, and I think that's when a lot of stuff starts to creep out that maybe folks didn't notice or parents missed. So let's talk a little bit about sort of some of the teenager stuff. Is they're wired to take risks, to take chances, to explore. But what are you guys seeing in your office as far as concerns that parents have and the struggles that young people are dealing with?
Well, I think some major concerns that come into our office, what prompts parents to actually seek therapy, is when they see their children really battling depression or social withdrawal that has been uncharacteristic for them in the past, high levels of anxiety, you know, perfectionism and putting intense pressure on themselves to be successful that maybe isn't even coming, you know, from the parents. Certainly ADHD and distractibility is another big factor. And then, you know, self-harm and suicidal thinking is something that pretty immediately will bring children into our office or, you know, prompt parents to seek support.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers are that about 1 in 5 adolescents experience a significant mental health problem at some point in adolescence. Krista, what are you seeing similar stuff? What kind of things are parents coming in and saying, this is what I'm afraid of, or this is what's triggered me to come into your office?
Well, I think a lot of times parents come into our office somewhat surprised, and I think Maureen covered a lot of what parents bring in, but sometimes parents are caught off guard that their child's in fact said, I need this support.
Certainly.
Perhaps they're really struggling within their social system and they have a peer that says, hey, I went to see a therapist, this was really helpful to me, and they go to mom and go to dad and say, hey, is it possible that I can talk to somebody? Lots of times parents are very surprised by this.
And on occasion, I think teachers or even school counselors can be the ones who prompt that as well, can be the ones who will contact a parent and say, you might consider seeking support. We're seeing these behaviors in the school setting or in after-school athletics that maybe you're not seeing at home.
Parents often, you know, I've noticed there's kids are sort of broken up into two categories. Some young people are asking, like you said, mm-hmm. Hey, can I talk to somebody? I'm really depressed. I'm struggling. And other times it's parents dragging their kid into my office, and the resistant child who does not want to come and doesn't see a problem with it. And those are a little more difficult. Can we talk a little bit how we get treatment resistant kids? I mean, getting a 13 or 14-year-old boy to go to his first therapy appointment to talk about his feelings with somebody that he doesn't know is a tall order. Krista?
I think the answer really depends on the acuity of the circumstance. I think Maureen and I feel very strongly that if this is a safety issue, if your child is self-harming, if you found poetry about death and dying, if you've been told by a friend that the child has mentioned suicide in the school setting to another adult or to another child, those are really situations in which seeking professional help is no longer something that should feel murky. We should immediately sort of be responsive to anything. The risk of being wrong, that this is nothing, is too high of a risk when we're talking about an unsafe child. And so in those cases, when it's incredibly acute, Maureen and I always say, tell your child, it isn't a question of if, it's a question of with whom. We are seeking this support. You can have buy-in to who you seek it with, but it is not a question of whether or not you will seek this support. And by setting that boundary, you really give the therapist the opportunity to sort of have this power play to connect with your kid that says you're going to be in somebody's office by the end of the day. It might be mine. It might be somebody else's. Let's see if we can make this work worthwhile together. And that can really help the alliance that the therapist can form with the child. The parent can be the bad guy, and the therapist can really swoop in there and maybe, in fact, be helpful in the way that parents are hoping that they can.
Absolutely. I think that it is, you know, oftentimes a really strange idea for children of what therapy is going to look like as well. And so even getting them to step foot in the office can, you know, help you make pretty great strides in getting towards a strong therapeutic alliance, because kids realize, gosh, this isn't so strange. Nobody's making me lay on a couch. They're not psychoanalyzing my dreams. I mean, unless that is what you're going to be doing in therapy, but most likely not with a teen, right? You're going to be really talking to them about how they're functioning and helping them live their life in the best way possible. And this is going to be something that they, as Krista said, really need to have some buy-in into. Therapy is not something that can be done to someone. It is something that they have to be a participant in.
Yeah, I mean, resistance is expected. And I often tell parents, your job is to get them here, and then my job is to try to get them interested enough to come back. They might not love it, but at least they're going to be willing. And I've often said those very words, is like, hey, your mom seems like the kind of person that's going to make you come somewhere. So it might as well be right. My office.
So you might as well stay here. Why yeah, start over, right?
Right, with somebody boring, yeah. Right? Because you don't know what you're going to get next time. Treatment or therapy with adolescents is a little bit different than adults. I mean, there has to, as you mentioned, somebody mentioned alliance, the word alliance, and it's mm-hmm. our job as adolescent therapists to make that happen. And I've often said that I don't think you can teach the skills to be an adolescent therapist. You can teach the knowledge in the background, but either they have it or they don't. So as a parent, you know, there's some advantages. I know everybody. I know all the therapists. So when my girls need something, I'm going to call Kristen, Maureen, and be like, hey, yeah, it can't be either one of you because, you know, we know each other. But, we know who to call and what questions to ask and how do we but how do parents who don't have any experience with this, say they've never been in therapy and their kids talking about suicide, cutting on themselves, where do they start? How do they find a good therapist?
I think that's a great question. I think, you know, I would really encourage parents to start with perhaps their pediatrician, school counselors, or even teachers. And, you know, better yet, if you're able to have that conversation in a trusting way, seeking the advice of friends with similar age children, word of mouth is really powerful, I think, especially in this community. And so really asking, you know, have your children ever been to therapy? Do you have a name of someone who's done well for you? And starting out in that way. And I also think if you really can't access any of those resources, pick up the phone and contact a local provider, because I think Krista and I really believe that we are as happy to take a client as we are to make a great referral. And there's been many times when we have, you know, had somebody on the phone seeking services that we don't quite offer, or we don't have space for, we will absolutely point you in the right direction. And I've had many other providers do the same in pointing people our direction.
Absolutely. Once we have a voicemail on our phone, we will not let that person go without having a next phone call to make. If we aren't going to be the answer they're looking for, we will make sure that we pass that along to a place where they will get the support that they need. And I think also about the resistance piece, sometimes, as hard as this is, if you cannot get your child in the door for an intake anywhere, if you cannot get them in the car, sometimes a psychiatric emergency room is the place to go. Because if your child is suicidal, your child is self-harming, and they are resistant to the lowest level of care to hopefully keep them at home, really being faced with possible inpatient hospitalization versus outpatient might motivate them to say, okay, if inpatient is my only option, I'll come to outpatient. I'll give this
a
try.
Sure, it's the lesser of two evils for them if they're avoiding therapy.
Right. And sometimes just that assessment in the psych ER is enough to really disrupt that cycle. And again, that would be different if it's a more nuanced problem than safety.
Right. Okay, if you're just tuning in to the program today, my guests are Anchorage therapists Maureen Young and Krista Pemberton from Fuller Diagnostics. Today we're discussing therapy for teens and preteens. How do you find a good one How do you know if it's working? Where do you begin and what should you expect from the process? If you have an experience you'd like to share, a question, or just a comment about today's topic, please don't hesitate to call in or email. If we don't have an answer for you, we'll point you in a direction, hopefully give you some resources that will help out. As always, you can reach us in three ways. Our local phone number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. You can also call us toll-free from anywhere you might be listening at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way to participate is by emailing your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. Okay, so after we decided to do this program, I was talking to a parent, and this parent was their kid wanted to see a therapist, and the parent was struggling because they said, "How do I, like, somebody's," and this is the first time I've ever heard it put this way, but said, "Somebody's going to be inside my kid's head. How do I know?" Like, that's super scary, and how much should they expect? And a lot of times therapy, you know, it's confidential. You want your kid to be able to talk to the therapist without thinking the therapist is going to go, like, tell everything. So how do we know? What should they expect when they take their kid to therapy? And does it depend on the situation, Maureen?
Well, I think, Krista, and I really believe that it is a huge honor to be trusted by parents to have a voice in your child's life and to be somebody who has an influence over your child, and we take that very seriously and really are thoughtful in doing so. I think it is hard for parents to trust another adult with your children and with, you know, their mental health, of course. And so we talk a lot in the intake session. So the intake session is the first session that you will have with a provider, which most typically will involve, you know, the parent or perhaps both parents, any other very influential caregivers in the child's life, and of course the child themselves. And in that session, you should have some pretty detailed conversations regarding confidentiality, what will and won't be shared, both with the parents and with the child. And I know for Krista and I in our practice, we absolutely do not keep secrets from children. So if parents are in communication with us regarding their worries and concerns, first off, we absolutely welcome that. We want to hear from parents. We need their perspective. Children may be great reporters of their own emotional experience and their own circumstances, but by nature of their age and mental development, do not necessarily have the full picture of what's happening in their life. But we will never keep secrets from kids. So if parents call and say, "Hey, this is going on, I'm worried about this, I read my child's diary," for example, that's happened a few times, we are not going to say to your kid, "Oh yeah, I haven't talked to your mom, I haven't heard, I don't know. I don't know anything about that." But we may not share the full content of what parents shared with us. We will certainly say, "You know, we spoke with your parents and this is something we need to talk about."
Yeah, I often, I tell parents quite often that if you call me, I'll tell your child that you called and what we talked about, and they have some concerns for you. And because I will have parents a lot call and say, "Oh, don't let them know that I called," because, and I'm like, "Well, I can't really get into that. That whole scene, because you know, the kid will find out that the parent called, and then your trust is shot." So trust with a teenager is delicate. Can you talk a little bit, Krista, about how you develop that trust with an adolescent?
I think so much of it is doing the work up front to really have this very, very profound conversation the first time you meet them about where these boundaries begin and end. And I think if you take a misstep in that first conversation and you aren't clear with what these boundaries are, you will make up for it for the rest of your therapeutic relationship with the child. So a couple of things that obviously will be true is, as therapists, we're mandated reporters of child abuse and neglect. That is not a secret that we can or will keep. And obviously, during the situation that a child is at risk to hurt themselves or others, that's the time that we'll have to pull in family members and refer to other supports. So those are times that trust will almost always be broken. And it is so important to make sure that a child understands that going into the conversation so they never feel that they've been betrayed. During the times that we have had to hospitalize kids or break that confidence, we have never done that behind a child's back. We will always say, "Hey, remember the first time I met you? This is what I told you was going to happen. I'm going to walk you through it step by step, but this is going to happen." And if it's ever been a circumstance where we had to change level of care, where we had to hospitalize a child because they're unsafe, I will be there the next day. I will show up. And I think that's an important part of trust, is to say, I will always be there, even if I have to violate the confidentiality piece of this for your safety and well-being.
And you will never walk out of our office and wonder if we're going to have to make one of those phone calls. It's never going to be done behind a client's back.
They're not going to get out to the car and then go to McDonald's and some ruse, and then the police will meet them there.
Nope.
Because that just ruins your credibility as a therapist for that child.
Nope. The police will come straight to the office if that's what's going to happen, and I will be there until the child is safely, you know, transitioned the whole time.
Okay. The risk of suicide. Now, there's a difference between a kid saying, oh, I just wish I was dead. I wish I was, you know, like, I don't want to be alive anymore, and having a real suicidal intent. And part of our job is to sort of tease that out sometimes. I mean, kids use it as a manipulation, but it's also a really scary, it's the number one scary thing for parents, right? Is it, because it's an impulsive reaction that can't be undone. So suicide is something that's scary and taken very seriously. How do you all assess risk and when there's a real threat?
Well, I think one thing that we talk to kids about a great deal is that there is a pretty big difference between saying, I wonder what it would mean if I wasn't alive anymore, or I wonder, you know, how people would respond if I was gone, versus I am actively considering taking my own life, or I have a plan to take my own life. And so having a conversation with a child, and also sometimes with the family, about what those differences are, and then being able to address safety planning. You know, a client who's willing to develop a safety plan, who's willing to say, these are the people I will call, these are the steps I will take to get support before I harm myself, is a really different client than one who says, and we've had this happen many times, where clients will say, kids will say, I can't promise you I'll stay safe. I can't commit to that. I really want to harm myself. And that's often a moment, you know, typically a moment when we seek hospitalization, because we want them to be safe 24 hours a day.
Yeah, that's always a tough one. We tend to err, you know, on the side of caution. And I liked what, Krista, what you said about if a child won't go to therapy and they're expressing those verbal outcries for help, our job, you know, as parents is to say, we will keep you safe, even if it's going to make you unhappy, right? We will always do Absolutely. What we think is in your best interest, regardless of whether you agree.
Absolutely. And I think another really important, you know, piece to confidentiality too, is to be able to tolerate these conversations while at the same time, you kind of mentioned parental responses often being, is this a plea for attention? And I think as hard as this is, because we don't want our children to seek attention in negative ways. We don't want these behaviors to be how they get their needs met. However, if this is where the child is starting and the child is doing this for attention, when a child's asking for attention, we give them attention. Right? That they're telling us they need something. Hopefully, if we can give them attention for the negative attention seeking, we can also help them through that rapport, through that alliance, really move that to positive attention seeking. Either way, the attention is necessary. So I respond to those the same way, whether they're serious or whether they're not serious. It's the same recipe.
Yeah, I said to a boy not too long ago, I was like, well, you got some attention. You're sitting in my office, and because he said, all I want to do is piss him off and, you know, like try to get in my way. I didn't really want to die. And I was like, well, they're paying attention, right? They heard you. They took you seriously. And I think that's an important message for young people, is, wow, my parents are not going to let me say these sorts of things and not react. Letting them know that, you know, I always have conversations with kids that parents wish they could have. Because the parents are so emotionally close and they get targeted as the bad guy, and you're incapable of having those conversations with your kids.
I think that is the real gift of therapy, is right. having a provider is having a therapist is somebody who does not have a stake in the choices that you make. Your actions will not impact their personal life, and that makes the relationship no less precious than a friendship or a relationship with a coach or a mentor. And in fact, in some ways, I think is more special. But it really is a rare gift to have a relationship with someone who can sit with you through some of those really dark thoughts and really hard times, knowing that those sessions, that time is 100% about the kid, and that we will not be reactive to those choices that they make or, you know, those thoughts that they have, that we will be able to be steady with them through it. Because parents aren't able to do that, and rightfully so. They are the parents, and with our own children, we will have to seek outside support if those type of problems come up too.
I think often with our surly teenagers, we can really underestimate how much teenagers care about their parents' emotional experience. And teenagers that are very attuned to how well their parents are doing in multiple directions in different ways, whether that's a caring way or a manipulative way, your emotional response is so entrenched with what they're going through at the time that often parents are at the most disadvantage in these more difficult moments to be a support to the child.
Yeah, they just can't be that person because of the closeness, because of the vulnerability, because of the history that they have with a parent. And Maureen, your point of somebody who's not, you know, like kids would tell me things, and if my kid told me some of these things, my head would explode. But I'm able to help them problem solve, figure out why that's maybe not such a great idea. Mm-hmm. Like maybe you ought to try a different approach to whatever this problem is, because that one's not working. All right, so you're looking for a therapist, and one of the things that I've found is once the stigma, like nobody wants to like say, well, I'm taking my child to a therapist, but if you start to ask your friends, and Maureen, you mentioned this, the best way, most of my referrals, and I'm sure most of yours, are word of mouth and from parents of other kids or parents that I've seen that know I see kids. That is, if somebody's had an experience with a therapist, that can really ease your mind. And I think with 1 in 5 kids suffering from mental health problems, you'll find that once you start talking about it, everybody's, oh yeah, well, we took our kid to Maureen, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And we have that same conversation with our clients as well. They sometimes believe that nobody else is in therapy, or perhaps nobody else is taking medication. Never mind the fact that, you know, 3 kids from your school are on my schedule this afternoon. Right. You know, we're obviously not going to tell them that, but it is so much more common than I think we realize when we get into this bubble of, you know, the belief that there has to be something incredibly wrong, that you only go to therapy when you're quote unquote crazy, and that is just not the case anymore.
Right. Yeah, therapy is bad. Mm-hmm. You don't only go to the doctor when you are dying. You don't have to wait to go to the therapist. In fact, young people who get into counseling at 15, 16 and start to learn some things about themselves and have a positive experience, so much of the work that I think we do with adolescents is preparation for, you know, 20s, because I get a lot of young people that come back in their 20s after a couple of years of college. And I mean, you guys have been in it long enough. You're starting to see those kids come back. And what are you finding that they're struggling with in college after they go from high school and transition?
Well, I think usually when kids come back in the college age, they really are so self-aware. They are no longer in this situation where the adults in their life or the systems in their life are telling them, you need to work on this. And they're at this place that is such a great moment therapeutically and so fun to work with, where they are self-actualized and they are absolutely able to tell you why they're on your couch, what they want to improve, and what they want to work on. And that resistance is really dissolved, and they are so, so open to wanting to take a look at these things. Often for me, I find the kids that really struggled with very severe acute issues with mood and anxiety in their teen years are often coming in for more nuanced things later, really working on relationships, working on motivation, working on building a little bit more insight. But of course, also just maintaining the things that they built the foundation of when you just made the great comment that you don't go to a doctor when you're dying. You also don't get to your, you know, dream physical state at the gym and then stop going when you're 22 and say, okay, I'm in great shape. I never have to go back again, right? Part of that is maintenance and using it as a tool that you can pick up and put down throughout your life when you need it, and having the good judgment to know when you do need that support.
Yeah, we have clients call us up sometimes, say, hey, Maureen, hey, Krista, I need a tune-up. I just need to come back in and check in.
Yeah, and oftentimes I find it's, you know, they're coming at Christmas, they're coming at summer break. They're like, oh, let me tell you about this year, and we'll talk through things. And you're absolutely right. It is really cool to see that shift from I'm here because my mom made me to like, whoa, like that stuff that we talked about happened. Just like, you know, just like it was predicted. And these are the things I'm struggling with. And it's really fun when that transition happens and they begin to engage. Okay, we're at the halfway point in our show, so we're going to go ahead and take a short break. If you have a question about anything related to teen mental health or adolescent therapy, or just a comment or experience you want to share, please don't hesitate to call in or email. Our local phone number is 550-8433, or you can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way to reach us is to email your questions or comments to line1@alaskapublic.org. This is your chance to, if you have a kid or a concern or a question about how do I get my kid in therapy, this would be a great time to call in, because we got three folks here who work with adolescents. So after this short break, we'll return to our conversation about teens and therapy. I'm Prentice Pemberton.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line One on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line One, your health connection on KSK Anchorage. I'm your co-host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just tuning into the program today, my guests are Anchorage therapist Maureen Young and Krista Pemberton from Fuller Diagnostics. Today we are discussing therapy for teens and preteens. How do you find a good one? How do you know if it's working? Where do you begin, and what should you expect from the process? Between the three of us, we're also here to answer, I think, pretty much any and all questions you might have about adolescent therapy. If you got a kid you're struggling with or a question for us, give us a call and we will give you some good information, hopefully, or point you in a direction that will help out. Well, I've also added quite a few resources online about teens and therapy, some good reading. In fact, there's one website on there for kids who have questions about therapy, and it's, you know, from a adolescent perspective, what questions they should ask, which I think is a great way to look at it. I think I'd like to do a follow-up show on this and have a couple of kids who've been in therapy and talk about why it was helpful and what it meant to them, you know, because that's a different perspective than us professionals kind of chatting about it. All right, so we've been talking quite a bit about, you know, some of the problems, anxiety, depression. I've mentioned the two types of kids. Either we have the highly anxious kids that are driving themselves, and my job, I think, is to talk them down. Like a 4.4 is not necessary, maybe. Like, are you going to Stanford Medical? That's the first question I ask, and if they say no, then I'm like, okay, well, maybe it. Maybe
well, sometimes they say yes.
I know. And then I say, okay, well, keep working super hard and be really anxious because you're signing up for that. Yeah. And then other kids are really struggling with motivation. They hate school. Maybe they're smoking weed too much, which is an issue that is coming up a lot in my office. It's marijuana. It's electronics. Social media concerns, especially with the young women, of which I have three that are growing up in this age, which is scary, concerning to say the least. And talking to you guys regularly doesn't help much with my anxiety about that. But it's a real thing. And I think parents need to be aware of what's happening and educate themselves. So if a parent is looking to find a therapist and they've talked to their parent or to their friends and they've got a good name, then they call, like, what's the process? Should they expect a call back? Do they have a question and answer session beforehand? How does this work? And I know every therapist works a little bit differently, but as a general idea, how can somebody feel pretty good about the person they're talking to?
I think it's incredibly important when a parent calls any provider's office to give enough kind of overarching information about what your child is struggling with so that we can be sure, you know, if we're going to put them on our schedule or make a referral for you to another provider, that we know that we're doing that well and doing that correctly. If you leave out a giant piece of information, we may not be the appropriate fit. And that's always really disappointing when you go through an entire intake session. You know, I have that first session with a provider and they say, well, I may not be the best fit for you for whatever reason. So really giving enough information up front over the phone so that we're able to make that decision initially. Because sometimes, for example, if your child is struggling, but a huge component of their struggle is a substance abuse problem, for example, then it may be more appropriate for them to be in the office of a substance abuse provider as opposed to a mental health therapist that does a little bit more general work.
Or if they have an eating disorder mm-hmm. or something specific that is, yeah, some severe childhood trauma, maybe Kimber Olson and those folks. So it's, yeah, asking around and giving good information to somebody can be very helpful. Christy, you look like you had something to add.
I think the logistics are important, too. I think a lot of people seeking therapy have multiple children. As Prentice said, three girls, right? You know what this is like. You're moving 50 different directions. Your schedule's already packed. You're working full time. What can you manage? If you really feel that, you know, your insurance coverage is an issue for you, about the reimbursement, if the scheduling is going to be an issue, that is a really important thing to ask up front. I would also really caution parents that if you are coming for something that feels acute, that feels incredibly important and incredibly overwhelming, such as safety or extreme oppositional behaviors, you're going to need a therapist that's going to be there consistently, and making sure that you get a therapist that isn't about to retire or that isn't taking 3 months off every summer, and that is really going to be able to be consistent throughout treatment if this feels like an issue that you will need that level of support for, are really good questions to start with before you ever come in the front door.
Like, are you moving to Florida in a few months? Yeah, are you going to be around for a while?
It happens.
Or do you only work on Thursdays? I mean, that type of thing.
Yep. Or okay. I don't work after 3 p.m., which is always a really hard one for – there are adolescent therapists that don't work after 3 p.m., which is always shocking for parents. But I think kind of a reality a lot of the time that is this enough to pull your kid out of school? And if it's not enough to pull your kid out of school, you're really going to be looking for one of very few therapists that probably have an immediate after-school opening.
That's an important one because I get that a lot. And if a therapist has lots of openings after school – is that something you should feel really confident in?
I think our schedules are always in such a state of flux. I think you're very lucky if you get a qualified provider who has an after school opening, but sometimes providers are transitioning. You know, for example, when I left my job in residential treatment into private practice, initially I had a lot of after school openings. I was just opening my doors. And so I don't think that is necessarily an indication of whether or not you are working with a quality provider, but I think that you're very lucky if you can get an after school spot.
I think you are, and I know it's important for parents that their kids not miss school. But I also say if they're getting straight A's and they can afford to miss a day, and if they're failing everything, it probably doesn't matter anyway. Like, there's more important things, and if they can get on track and start to feel better and gain some confidence, then school will take care of itself. But what's happening now is not important. So the after school piece, don't rule it out just because it doesn't fit, because you'll call around and you won't find a lot.
Sure, and I think depending on the client struggles, sometimes individual sessions are not the only approach. I know that Krista and I do a large number of groups, and many of those are in the evenings, and all day on Saturday we have groups, and so sometimes if pulling your child out of school is a deal breaker because of your own work schedule or because of the child's academic needs, sometimes starting in a group is a great place to start until the schedule opens up. you know, or even starting with family sessions.
Let's talk a little bit about groups. I'm glad you brought it up. Group therapy, you guys do a lot. Not a lot of places do a lot of groups. It's tough to organize. It's tough to get kids in and consistently. But what's the advantage of the group modality for kids? And is there a specific type of kid that benefits from a group?
Well, I think a specific type of kid really benefits from a specific type of group. And I think it's essential that you're really matching that group to that child. Social skills is a huge one. I think children that are struggling socially really, really can talk face-to-face with an adult about that for as long as they can.
Right.
But once they've learned those skills, they need a place to practice with some guidance and some feedback. And that's the whole group mentality is we're gonna learn these skills in an individual, we're gonna practice them in group, and then we're gonna generalize them to your life outside a group. And it is just one of the tools that Maureen and I absolutely find the most useful for children and adolescents. Very informative for us too, because we might have a child that we really don't see any of these struggles with in our office, and then all of a sudden, you know, the heavens part, and we see
them in
this
group, and you say, ah,
yeah,
okay,
yes,
that's what we were looking
right.
for, right?
Sunbeam on our new goal, right? And so that is, you know, also just as a diagnostic tool and an assessment
right.
tool, incredibly powerful with youth.
The groups, they don't have to have the same group counselor that they do individual, would they? Could they go to a group individual counselor and then go to a group with a different counselor?
Yeah, absolutely. We've really done that both ways, although I think over the years, Krista and I have started to lean towards having our individual clients in group because that is the most beneficial setup for us, because there are many times when a child will have a behavior in the group setting that we aren't necessarily going to want to talk to them about in the group.
Right.
We may want to bring it up in individual session and say, hey, I've noticed that you're having these responses, this type of behavior, this may be pushing your peers away. Let's talk about it privately and then work on it back in the group setting. And so the providers that have referred kids to us for our groups have been wonderful in remaining connected. And, you know, we talk with them frequently about how their client is doing in our group. But the ability to schedule an individual session to be able to talk about something that's coming up in group on a more regular basis is really, really important to us. And so it's our groups have become much more full of our own clients for that reason.
Okay. I do want to remind folks that you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. My guests today are Anchorage therapist Maureen Young and Krista Pemberton from Fuller Diagnostics. Today we're discussing therapy for teens and preteens. How you find a therapist, how do you know if it's working, where do you even start, and what should you expect? So if you have a question or a comment in the next 10 minutes, please give a call or email in so we can get you on the air. Our local phone number is 550-8433. You can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And you can email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. Okay, I got a few emails here. I want to go ahead and read some. One is from somebody that I know is a professional, Diana Seropian from Prov. And she wants to know if you guys can speak to resources for mental health therapy for adolescents who are on Medicaid. It seems to be a very difficult issue in our state. Every time I do one of these shows, this comes up. Huge waiting list. Krista, you look like you're chomping at the bit to answer that one.
Chomping at the bit to answer and solve the problem, which is, you know, absolutely. I wish there was a great answer to this question, but the answer is that the resources are really unavailable due to Medicaid regulations that just don't work for our state makeup and population. And so I think, Prentice, you mentioned, and I've listened to almost all of your shows, so I know you guys have talked about this on the program before, but regulations as they stand really don't allow many of the credentialed professionals, the LPCs, the LCSWs, and, you know, even, you know, psychologists be billing for Medicaid clients without having a psychiatrist and a medical professional that shares a threshold. And with the very small amount of medical professionals that we have doing child psychiatry in Alaska and the large amount of need that we have for these particular youth to achieve services, there is this incredibly long waiting list where there just aren't providers to see these kids. And it is really pushing this very horrible dynamic where kids that could have their needs met by a lower level of care. Kids that could see benefit in the community are really being filtered into residential treatment settings because those options are available for Medicaid to bill. It's a really big problem. It's a regulation problem, and it's something that we obviously, as our field, the three of us sitting here, and I think also the lady on the email, we need to probably have some more advocacy for moving forward for our state.
It is a system problem. We're talking about young people who are on 6 to 9 month waiting lists to get a therapy appointment, an intake appointment, not even a medical appointment to assess for meds. And LPCs, you mentioned LPCs, licensed professional counselors, LCSWs, licensed clinical social worker. Those are people that are qualified to see children, to treat mental health, children and adults, and to bill health insurance for that service. Medicaid is the only one that does not allow us to do that.
Even supervision. Medicare will allow us to.
Even Medicare. Mm-hmm. But Medicaid, without supervision of a psychiatrist who may or may not see that kid, even if they don't have medications, they still are required. And that's where the waiting lists are coming from. And it's a big problem because, as you mentioned, Krista, if a kid is waiting outpatient and is acting out, where is he going to end up? Prov, North Star, right? I mean, McLaughlin.
And if there's not a way to discharge them to the community with a safe plan, that child's going to be referred to residential treatment because there's no
Correct.
Other option.
Yeah, and the bring the children home movement, and we don't have enough resources for the Medicaid clients. So that is a political, and that's got to be changed. But, just to jump on, my soapbox for a minute, there is no reason why we should not be able to see those kids without psychiatric supervision. And if we deem that they would benefit from medical care, we would refer them to psychiatric just as we do our private insured.
And I think this was an advocacy issue about a decade ago for neuropsychology as well, where neuropsychologists were not allowed to bill Medicaid, and there were so few in the state that, it became such a huge issue. And they were successfully able to change those regulations about 10 years ago for the neuropsychology field. So this is something that obviously, through a little bit of action and advocacy, can be improved.
And I've heard that there are people working on this and advocating mm-hmm. for this. So talk to your representatives and talk to people who have some power and can maybe change that rule so we can serve more of these kids and not use up beds and resources when we could better serve them in an outpatient setting. Okay, another email. I have a 12-year-old granddaughter who is causing turmoil in the household. She lives with my daughter and her husband as well as part-time 10-year-old sister. Blended family, 12-year-old and her 10-year-old. Problem seems to be the 12-year-old can't seem to see beyond her own world. She yells at mom and dad as well as her stepsister, seeming without realizing she's yelling. When confronted, she either denies yelling, shuts down. The questions we have are, how can we help her see herself? Is this negative attention-seeking behavior? What can we do to stop it? The 10-year-old is feeling like staying with her other family because of how negative the household has become. So, family therapy, individual therapy, what do you think?
Well, I think going back a little bit to the idea of attention-seeking behavior, if a child is attention-seeking, let's give them attention. And I think if this is becoming so problematic in the home that other family members are wishing to not be present, then it's become a pretty big issue. And so I would encourage this family to start by seeking perhaps individual therapy, doing an intake session initially. But by the end of an intake session, you should have a pretty clear sense of what the recommendations are from the provider moving forward. And so that may mean that family therapy would be more appropriate. It may mean a combination of both individual and family, where perhaps you're not doing traditional family therapy, but the parents are being pulled into sessions or caregivers are being pulled into sessions to work on the child's individual needs, or even group therapy. So I think starting with an intake session now, while these problems are presenting themselves, and really getting the support in place so that they don't become a larger issue.
I think also this really goes back to a question that I'm not sure we had the time to answer as thoroughly and as well as we wanted to, which is that during that intake session, your therapist is going to be really nosy. They're going to ask you a lot of questions.
Right.
We're going to ask you a lot of questions to get caught up on your story. We're going to be incredibly thorough. And the reason for that is that this is a very hard question to answer without assessment. There could be so many moving pieces that explain this behavior that this child is experiencing. And really, your therapist will be trained to be able to take that intake information and boil it down to at least the best place to start. That can really transform throughout the course of therapy. You might really enter into therapy thinking you're working on one issue. 6 months later, a real deep problem comes out that might be explaining all these pieces better, and the therapy takes an entire different direction. That can be a really organic process sometimes.
And when you start with a child as young as 12, that is often the case. As they age, the direction of therapy, the support that they need can really evolve.
And with a good directive therapist, they will be able to tell you why that is. This is why we're starting here. This is what I'm seeing as the clinical picture now. This is the frequency and the type of session I want to start with. These are the questions I want to have answered. These are my goals for where we want to end up. And as that changes, your therapist should be in touch with the family, being directive as to what they're seeing if that evolves.
Okay, here's a question up y'all's alley. I'm the parent of a teenager who has a history of self-harm and has threatened suicide. Three different therapists about to see a fourth. I have two questions. First, she refuses to open up to a therapist and is stubbornly opposed to the idea at all. How do I know when I found the right therapist, and when will we know if it's working or not? Which was kind of my next question, how do you know it's working? Second question is it okay for me to share with the therapist that my daughter has had a traumatic event in her past and she's unwilling to share it herself? So parents giving information that kids don't want shared. Maureen?
Well, I think it is incredibly important to be able for this mom to be able to say to this child, I will continue to support you in finding the right provider. I mean, what research really tells us is the therapeutic alliance, regardless of modality, regardless of therapeutic approach, is the most important determining factor in whether or not therapy will be successful.
That relationship.
So really supporting the child and finding the right fit for them. But I think that you don't need your child's permission to share that information, but one way to go about it that may help the child feel like they have a little bit more control is to say, this is a piece of your story that your provider really needs. You know, we need Maureen or Krista or whomever you're seeing to know this about you because it's such a key factor. But I will either share that information with you in the room or you can step out of the room. We will make that as safe as possible for you, but it isn't a secret that we can keep.
Right. This is information that your therapist needs to have.
Absolutely.
I would be really curious about how therapy ended with the other therapists and what insight they may be able to give you. They may be your greatest resource in saying, this is what worked, this is what didn't work, this is what I'm seeing might be more helpful moving forward, mm-hmm. helping you to identify what barriers they were unable to overcome. But at the end of the day, if you're cycling through therapists and outpatient treatment isn't working, this is a question of level of care. And sometimes right. The next question might be, if your child is continuing to be suicidal and self-harming, not able to be productive in therapy, and you feel like you have had this pattern, given it a good duration of effort, tried many, many different things, there are so many really amazing programs at Anchorage that can really help for a reset. One that just pops to mind for your situation might be the Crisis Recovery Center, which is a great program that could be a really brief stay to help this child work through that their buy-in to therapy, the benefit of that.
Normalize a little bit being in therapy because you would be in treatment with other adolescents.
Absolutely. And often for me, what I have noticed can be so transformative for clients that I have found this level of resistant is sometimes trying a different medium, sometimes throwing them in a group. Right. Because sometimes, I mean, I've definitely had clients that stared at me for 45 minutes. Those are incredibly long sessions. And just absolutely wouldn't that just light up in group. And I actually, you know, have seen that be so transformative for kids and breaking through that resistance to therapy. So might be some different things you can try. And I think I would certainly, with this new therapist that you're about to do an intake with, really lay out these concerns and say, I really don't know where to go from here. This is what we tried. What is your strategy going to be? And what do you think?
And signing those releases to speak with the former providers, I think, is really great input because, as you said, they may have some puzzle pieces. They may have some information that would help you know how to move forward.
All right. Thanks for that email. Going to go to another one. My child was sexually abused by a biological father. Father is now in jail. After 5 years of counseling, things are worse than rather than better. Three different counselors, family counseling with all of us, and month-long hospitalization for cutting. All instances, the child either lied so counseling would end or sat silently and refused to talk. 17-year-old child ready to leave home soon, unwilling to communicate, barely unwilling to work with me on the littlest things. What can I do?
Well, I think my answer is actually kind of similar to the one that I gave at the last point.
Very similar.
17 is a delicate age. You are really at that period of aging out of your ability to get help for your child. And so you might really want to capitalize on this moment where those resources are still available. We certainly have a huge gap in our ability to provide this level of support to kids that are 18, 19, and 20 that are really not at that age where they are going to fit into that adult world of services but have then aged out of the adolescent services that are available in town. So this might be time to do one last ditch effort of saying, you know, does this child need some level of an acute hospitalization stay if this outpatient setting isn't working? I also would maybe refer you guys to Changing Tides. Sounds like some complex trauma. Not sure what therapist you've seen or where you've been, but I think really trying to start with is the complex trauma the issue and have we really received adequate attention to the complex trauma?
And also, I think really remembering, as we spoke about earlier, that sometimes you're planting seeds in therapy and the benefit of the conversations you've had and the work that you've done doesn't always show up right away. And so remembering that, like we talked about with 25-year-olds, you know, returning to therapy after being kind of forced into therapy and resistant to it as teenagers is sometimes the real gifts of therapy come out later in life. And I think there needs to be some pretty strong action right now for this family. And as Krista said, kind of a last-ditch effort to get as much support as possible. But I think also having some faith that the good work that's been done is going to show up down the road, too.
Yeah, that's really tricky as parents get closer to that magic 18 age and they're like, oh, it's 16 and a half. I got to get them in residential treatment right now. This is my last chance. And there is some truth to that. And I always hear this from kids. Well, I won't go. I'll run. I'll kill myself for real then. And that's emotional sort of manipulation and blackmailing of their parents. So be careful not to fall into that. But this case sounds like lots of attempts have been made, and it may be that a higher level of care would be appropriate, especially with that history of complex trauma. Changing Tides, Krista mentioned, is a organization in town, a collection of therapists that specialize in complex trauma. So that might be a good resource for you. In fact, Kimber Olson's been on the radio show before, and she's sort of the lead over there, one of the main therapists over there. So certainly worth looking at. It's a tough road. Hang in there. Keep plugging away. So we're at the end of our show. A couple of seconds just to give us something to take home for parents.
I think our greatest hope on coming on the show today was really just that this can feel, as we mentioned several times in the show, inaccessible logistically, inaccessible politically, but also sort of emotionally inaccessible. I don't know where to start. I don't know what questions to ask. I don't know where to begin. And obviously, you're not asking these questions unless you are already struggling, already feeling somewhat of pressure or crisis in your home. And so what we're really just hoping at the end of today is that this type of support just feels a little bit more manageable, a little bit more predictable, and that parents know that those resources are available and that they will use them if there's any concern whatsoever.
Maureen?
Absolutely. Call and ask. Parenting is hard. You know, we always hear there's no rule book for it, no guidebook for it, but seek the support and trust that you will be pointed in the right direction.
All right. Well, I appreciate you both taking the time to join me today. It was fun. Check out the variety of links and information we've made available on today's topic on our show page. Well, headaches affect us all. Most are transient and a nuisance. Some can be symptoms of serious illness arising from problems both inside and outside of the head. Others can be chronic and debilitating. On the next program, Dr. Woodard welcomes Dr. Andrea Trescott for a discussion on pain specialists' approach to headaches. So why not tune in and learn more Monday, November 27th. on Alaska Public Media. Eric Bork handled the web editing for today's program, and Dave Waldron was our audio engineer. For all of us at Line One, thanks for taking the time to join us. I'm Prentice Pemberton.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.